Welcome, Steve Connolly from Hodder Education, to talk on this podcast about your new platform launch. I wondered if first perhaps you could tell us about your role, how long you've been at the company, and you know what you've been doing really with yourself.
Well, I joined Hodder Education in 1994, so I've been there 27 years or so, and I began as a production controller coming straight out of a post after my degree. I went to what is now London College of Communications and did their postgraduate in publishing, and worked in various roles through editorial, publishing, list development, that kind of thing. And then in 2003, I was asked whether I'd be interested in sort of trying to start a digital aspect to the publishing. Right. And it coincided with the BBC doing their online curriculum and e-learning credits being provided by the government. And since then, we've sort of gone through various iterations and revolutions, including whiteboards and iPads and Chromebooks and so on. Okay. And so now what I'm primarily asked to do is to head up a team that works with all functions of the business to create platforms, content, workflow for the business. Yeah. And that's culminated in a lot of cloud-based services. So that's my okay. background.
Fantastic. Well, that's great to know. And it sounds like you've been there a really long time, actually. Yeah. You predate my publishing career. I'm not sure whether I should admit that to you.
Listen, I have a card from someone at work that was given to me, and it said, "You've been here longer than I've been alive."
Really?
So that was the bit where I really... Yeah, there you go.
Okay. So... in terms of Hodder Education, I've looked and I'm familiar with some of your resources, but I wonder if you could give us like a overarching sweep of what Hodder does
for people. Hodder Education is part of the Hachette Livre UK group, so it's the educational publishing division essentially. And broadly speaking, it falls into primary, assessment, secondary and vocational areas, and there's also an international publishing list that's both export and international specific publishing for curriculum. We also have offices in Scotland, in Jamaica and Singapore, so it's truly
nice
global
places,
yeah, so it's, you know, we publish for local curricula as well, including Jamaica and other parts of the Caribbean. And I think what characterizes the business in a way is its diversity. And yet there are lots of common streams and themes to what we do as well. And digital, alongside some of the other central services, is the obvious place where you can utilize solutions for one part of the business different contexts. So
there's a really wide ranging set of digital resources then, and also kind of markets that you're marketing to. That doesn't make very good sense.
Well, certainly operating within, and as I said, that's a mix of kind of exported UK curriculum publishing and international, you know, very specific international publishing, whether it's for qualifications which are used across the world, like international baccalaureate or IGCSE or, you know, international A level, or it's local curriculum where they want to produce the equivalent of our primary or secondary lists, but for their local requirements.
Okay, really wide ranging then, definitely. So the reason I got in touch with you, and we've been in touch over various things, was to talk to you about your new digital platform. I kind of wanted to understand what that was, and also the journey to kind of launch it, how painful or, you know, easy it was to launch. And so, I just wondered if you could maybe describe the platform and how it's been received first.
Sure. So we've had a legacy platform called Dynamic Learning for a long time. That started on CD-ROM and was delivered ostensibly for the whiteboards originally. It was front of class teaching material, so it's very teacher focused. And it went online in about 2010 and then was overhauled in 2013. But in web technology terms, that's ancient. And so the decision was made to revisit curriculum delivery for both teachers and students. And we hired a product manager, someone who would go out and talk to the market So we had the voice of the customer from the very start, from the get-go. We had digital design workshops where we looked at what we'd done previously and we tried to tease out principles of what teachers were looking for. And this was all pre-pandemic. I mean, this dates back to 2017-18, you know.
Okay, so it's quite been a while ago now.
Quite a while ago. But we started in earnest in around 2018, latter part of 2018 and into 19. And what we wanted to do was create a service which would be responsive. That was the first thing. And I think the pandemic really highlights the digital divide that there is. So mobile phones are very often the only piece of kit in a lot of households, and being able to access content that way was important. That was using the latest web technologies that could either sit on a kind of a local network, a sort of physical network, or in the cloud. Things that were API driven, so you could have microservices linked together. And also we looked at workflow. So we looked at how editorial and authors and others could produce different types of content and curate them and upload them.
So would you say you're digital first and mobile first now, or have you taken a different track in?
Well, I'd say that the mobile responsive, we're customer first.
Okay.
So the idea is that you start with the principles of what really matters to them, whether they're a pupil or a teacher, that you can exemplify and test that through kind of rapid prototyping of wireframes and designs. And then those principles are enshrined in kind of the development map, if you like, prioritized. But one of the challenges is always when you're trying to think about what the workflow will be to deliver material through to that framework.
Yes, of course.
And to fulfill the promise of it. So we were sort of running in parallel, creating a headless CMS, a headless content management system. And that can be connected to any of our sites, actually.
Right, not so it's kind of separate content archive.
Separate content curation and upload and all those things. Any site can now connect to that. But the new framework Boost, it was built by interviewing a lot of teachers, a lot of students, and really understanding what their habits were, how they wanted to share content and access content, what was important to them in all of that. And this all happened pre-pandemic, actually. So we actually were doing the bulk of the build during the pandemic,
right.
working remotely with all the teams. So that was quite a challenge in itself.
Did you find the requirements changed as you were working through last year?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Although I would say actually what they did was amplify the requirements. So things like single sign-on or sharing content through third-party platforms, that kind of thing. Because schools, you know, we have to be mindful of the fact that teachers have very little time.
Yeah, of course.
And schools like to have, if they have a really strong digital policy or content sharing policy, then they tend to want to get the staff to do things in standard ways because they can support Google Classroom or Teams or whatever it might be. And that became really important during the pandemic because they needed to have a policy that was safe, that was usable and manageable. And so if you have services that interact with those systems and don't demand that you learn a whole new skill set in terms of using proprietary platforms like ours, then that's a good thing.
Google, yeah.
That's right. Yeah. So you can start creating your own content and share it through Teams or Google Classroom, but you can also use commercial services that interconnect with them. And then you're doing it all in one place.
Yes.
I think it's about knowing your place as a content provider within that ecosystem, really.
Yes. So have you got kind of a map of where you fit? Does that make sense?
Well, I think the honest answer to that will be where we fit will be different for different people who we're selling to. So it could be that for primary schools, we fit in a reading scheme and the delivery of that. For secondary schools, we fit within a framework that includes the use of Google Classroom alongside teacher resources, alongside stuff from Oak National Academy.
I've seen them.
Other services. So I think it does vary, but what you want is a standard way of being able to explain what you can do with what we do.
So do you kind of integrate through APIs with those other resources, or do you pull other things in? Does that make sense?
Yes, so people can upload their own resources and create previews of those pieces of content, but we also have the sharing, the sharing out. So the important thing is that you can have single sign-on, ideally. I mean, you don't have to use it, but it's useful. And then once you've done that, being able to actually share the content out to those platforms seamlessly, you know, you see this now, it's becoming ubiquitous, and I think rightly so. And for a long time, teachers were saying, just give me one way of logging into the services that I use and that my pupils use, and also allow me to share content through those services. So I think the frameworks have matured to a point now where customer expectation is there, and I think commercial providers are going there as well.
Yeah, of course. So I think when we first met, we were talking single sign-on a lot during that period in 2017. How have you managed to solve that issue for your customers?
Well, there's two, I mean, within the Hodder frameworks, there is the principle of single sign-on within our services. So if you have a marketing site, log in as a teacher, you can log into your subscription services using that same login. That's step one. Step two is to integrate with Microsoft and Google. Those are the two principal ones that we use. So you don't have to log in using your classroom or your Teams, or sorry, your Google or your Microsoft credentials, but it just makes the whole thing seamless when you start to utilize the sharing options and those kind of things. It's just liberating on that front, and it means that you can just reduce the number of logins that you're having to think about. Ultimately, what it also means is if you've got key bits of demographic data, like identifiers for your pupils, you can actually start sharing data as well. It can be, it's safe to transfer, it's anonymized, but it can be consolidated in data trackers and things like that.
So I assume when you say safe, you mean because you've got, you know, people under 18, then there's a safeguarding issue, and that's that means, I guess, security is a massive priority for your organization.
Absolutely, and that's about where you hold data, how you hold it, how you encrypt it, how you transfer it, and it's also about what gets transferred for what purpose as well, under GDPR, just to make sure that
privacy,
you're only ever collecting the data you need for the service, and you're only ever utilizing that in a safe way, where where a school is controlling the flow of data to third-party systems, like data trackers and you know, that kind of thing, or from MIS to us for being able to create student accounts and that sort of thing. If you do that safely and securely, you're really only transferring the little bits of information, and you do not append the personal information to those identifiers. That's the key thing.
From your point of view as a vendor, then, how does that impact on your kind of user behavior insights and the statistics around the purchases that people make? Is it really delicate how you integrate those things?
It is, and I think it's about aggregating and anonymizing. So ensuring that personal data is not surfaced. I mean, essentially what all vendors are doing is processing data to be able to provide a service. But the people who should be in control of that data, of course, are the schools themselves. And they should remain the data controllers unless they need us to do something and have given specific consent. So as long as you're essentially providing a service that uses processes pieces of data that are provided by the user for the purpose of serving that need, then you're okay. And I think that's if you draw the line there, then that's the real balancing act that you have to
make sense.
And the problem there is that schools, obviously, the onus is on them to control the data. The onus is on them to ensure that they that they're not providing access to that data for third parties unless it is absolutely necessary for the provision of the service. You know, schools are the ones who have consent from the people who own the data, who are the individuals or the parents in the case of minors, you know.
It's kind of a buy-in process.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a chain effect, essentially.
Yes. And then the biggest impact, I always think, of a launch on an organisation.
Sorry, one second. I'm just going to shut the door because my other dog came in and he's opened the door. So I'm just going to shut it in.
Well, a dog featuring in the podcast isn't a bad thing.
No, they seem to be ubiquitous.
Lighten the mood, kind of.
They seem to be ubiquitous, don't they? So, yeah, sorry. Yeah.
So I was going to say, on platform launch, Yep. And often there's a flurry of technical support queries. So in light of the new platform launch, how was your, what was the sort of customer response to that, and how did you manage the transition into business as usual?
Well, business as usual was also in a state of flux because there was a massive migration of the company's stock from one warehouse to another and to a whole new level of accounting systems. Mm-hmm. So actually the what was already a big task was exacerbated by the fact that there was all of this kind of other logistical stuff going on in the background. The answer to that is we actually managed it pretty well, I think, because we treated it not as a big bang, but a soft launch. And we had schools who'd been really kind of consulted from the very beginning of the project. Mm-hmm. They were happy to take out kind of subscriptions. They weren't paying for them, but they were happy to test the user journey. And that did expose a few things, whether it's just an email that hasn't got the right bit of copy in it, or you know, a piece of data that wasn't stored correctly in the subscriptions and that kind of thing. So
did you go for a beta launch first? Sorry, I just wanted to clarify.
Kind of. It was the full service. So and we pretty thoroughly tested it. We thoroughly tested it, but it wasn't so much beta in that sense. I think it was beta in the sense of your experience of going to the website and taking a subscription as a school. Where were the key sticking points? Were there any issues that arose that we had to address, whether it was just kind of whitelisting IPs or whatever it might be.
Okay.
So it was the full service. We released a couple of things post-launch, but most of it was there and most of it was working well. Yeah.
That's good to know. Did you do any capacity or performance testing in advance? I assume there was a mass of users that you were expecting. So
we did. We load tested and it was tested across all the functions within the environment. And obviously it'll get exponential growth. So the trick is just to keep monitoring it. But the idea is that it's built in a kind of way that allows it to have additional resources added very quickly if required. But it's not actually cloud-based at the moment in the sense that it's not cloud-hosted. It's online, but it's not cloud-hosted. But it's built in such a way that it can move from the physical servers that we have in the data centers to the cloud. So,
And then when you say that, I always think business continuity. So in terms of, let's not wish for a disaster, but in case of emergency, how would you plan for that in the transition to the cloud or as you are hosting it now?
Well, it's all backed up regularly and there are, you know, multiple data centers. So there's failover in that sense. And in terms of migrating to the cloud, I mean, the good thing is because it's all API driven, you can move different parts of the service to the cloud at different times, as long as you're mapping everything and continuing to get everything to talk to one another. So it's not like the old big monolithic things of old where you had to move it all or it was all or nothing. You can do it incrementally.
Yeah, so it's a kind of a modular shift in a weird way.
That's right. And it's applications that perform specific functions that deliver the service.
Yes, yes.
And so you can move those, incrementally. Yeah. And the other thing is you can also, because it's containerized, you can also share functions across different iterations of those services. Yes. So some will be shared and some will be unique. And that's a good way to go as well.
Okay. And then shifting gear slightly from the technical to the prettier aspect, how did you manage the user experience and designing the user interface before you launched?
When we'd done the design workshops where we were talking about the requirements gathering for what it needed to deliver, then we started to build Axures and Adobe XD files to actually wireframe everything. And that was before we had an interface design, actually. So we were really testing the principles of user journey and functions. And then we went out to a design agency for an initial set of kind of skins to put onto the final wires that we had. And we hadn't wireframed the whole service by any stretch of the imagination, just the top level functions. And then it iterated from there. And what we were doing was constantly testing the next set of functionality and how that would interact with the previously built sets of functionality. And that's my cat.
That's all right. There's a background noise of pets, everyone.
Yeah, it's a madhouse. But there you go. Sorry.
I think it's inevitable when you've got kids and animals in the house, but it's always going to be noisy working from home.
Well, she may continue to moan, but we'll see.
Right. See how it goes. So how have your users responded to the refreshed user interface, if you like?
Well, it's early days, but it's very positive. And I think the thing is, we've also not just launched one service, we've actually launched two, because a partnership with the Charland Learning Limited, which is born out of Charland Collegiate Academy Trust, it wasn't one service, it was actually an iteration of Boost called EduSchool, which has also launched. It launched about a month later.
Wow.
So, and that had new functionality in it as well. So it had kind of web pages driven view as well as resources, but it was driven by the same CMS and it was built on the same framework. So you could apply a skin to a new iteration of it very quickly. So it's, you know, that's the advantage of what's been built there. Yeah.
Amazing. So it sounds like you've got a very nimble build process and platform.
We have now, but it takes a lot of planning, and you have to do it in such a way that it, the potential is there. It's just making sure that you've got things configured in such a way that you, and I think one thing you didn't mention at the beginning was, what was the business logic? It's not just what's the user, what are the business requirements for this thing? And when you've got a business which also needs to operate internationally, and you potentially want to be able to spin up different versions of things, that's the key thing, is, you know, have you built that logic in right at the very beginning?
Yes. And then going through that build, it sounds like, you know, substantial transition planning required to get to this nimble platform. What was the best thing about the way you approached it, and what lesson would you have taken from your approach? Because it's a long project, 2 years, 2-3 years, it's a long project.
We ideally, you don't do it in a pandemic. No. In terms of the build.
Coronavirus cross.
yeah, that's probably a bad idea. That's a good question. I think that the lesson learned is probably you can go out with less than you ultimately intend to look to the service to deliver. So actually defining a better minimum viable product would be what I would do differently, I think. So you don't have to build all of the functions that people are talking about right up front. You can iterate over time, and it gives you a reason to go back and talk about the value of your service improving and expanding and those kind of things. So
it sounds like you used a very agile process. Did you do any kind of requirements phase that was kind of solid waterfall at the beginning, or was it completely agile all the way through?
No, it wasn't completely agile in the sense that we'd done the design workshop. So we already had a framework, and you can utilize an agile methodology within that. That's not a problem. But I think I'm a firm believer that you've got to have a set of basic principles and parameters that your service is going to deliver. Because without that, it's quite difficult, particularly if you're building content management system that needs to feed it. You've got to be able to make those two things work together. And if you keep riffing and changing and iterating too much in terms of what the end user is going to see, you end up in trouble. So it's a balancing act, I think.
Okay. And in terms of infrastructure and team, were you predominantly internal expertise, third party suppliers, and how did you kind of grasp the holistic view of the planning as well as, you know, the detail of the requirements?
Yeah, so I think the key thing was to have all stakeholders in the business represented first of all. So what was the sales model going to look like? What were the key marketing messages? What were the design elements? How would it interface with the finance department systems, content management, digital marketing, that kind of stuff? So that's having a really good working group there. We also had working groups looking at different aspects that needed to come together around workflow, ebooks, that kind of stuff. And then in terms of the actual build, there were digital project managers internal who were responsible for managing the project in JIRA and defining user stories and all of those kind of things. And the testing, we had a QA person internally, but also at the developers, they were QAing and load testing. And then the development was all done out of house. So we don't do any of that internally.
Yes.
And actually there is a licensed bit of software built into, I mean, there are licensed components, but there are licensed, there's one element to the service which is licensed, but the rest of it, yes, is proprietary and built and owned by Hachette in terms of its IP.
Okay. So. And in terms of the nerds and the developers out there, what sort of code base and technology did you employ?
Well, it's built on the latest .NET frameworks and SQL, okay, databases, but it uses a containerized solution. So it's all API driven. So it's all got documented APIs. And actually, from a content management point of view, that's quite good because it means you can also potentially license your content out to third parties if you, mm-hmm, give them,
yes,
access to specific elements of content through the API. So you don't even actually have to distribute it. You can, well, you distribute it, but you don't have to lift the content out and send it to someone. You can just allow, right, them to have certain access rights.
Yes, yes.
So there's a lot of potential there.
So you kind of got layers and layers of access, is that true?
That's right, yeah, and different permissions set within that. And then there's also, of course, the analytics. So there's a, yes, data warehouse which is hoovering information up, albeit anonymized.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the user can see what their interactions look like, but the data warehouse can pull in aggregated data and surface it for internal business intelligence and that kind of thing. So yeah, there's lots of different approaches to all of this, but I come at it from the point of view of what would I as a publisher also want to, mm-hmm, put in there, and how would I want to publish frameworks for supporting anything from, mm, primary reading schemes through to GCSE economics or A-level, yes, psychology. Yes. So okay. Yeah, so it's been quite complex, but it, you know, but in
those terms of the business overall, did you restructure your business model, change the way subscriptions are bought, and how has the kind of cascade of the new platform affected the business as a whole, you know, your financial people, your support people, sales people, all that communication link as well?
Well, there's been a lot of training going on and a lot of support, right, documentation being written for supporting the services, and the sales teams have had to get to grips with things. There are shared commonalities in, okay, in terms of principles with the previous platforms, but new features as well, certainly. And it's all about, you know, knowing who you're talking to when you show them it on your laptop or your phone or whatever, so that those principles don't change. The subscription models have been adjusted. We had a sort of iterative development, I guess, of subscription types and models from previous platforms, and there was some confusion around what this represented or what that represented.
Yes.
But one of the key things that we, well, I was very keen that we tried to emulate was the flick test on a book, so being able to try before you buy sort of thing.
Okay.
So actually you can go to the Boost framework and browse all of the content, albeit on a limited view, yes, of all that content, but you can go and search the platform, you can go and look at courses, right, before you've even taken out a trial, which is not typical for these kind of paywalled services. Yes, yes. So we're trying,
that's
to,
nice, like a freemium kind of bit in a way,
sort of, but there are free elements that are, right, given away on the marketing site and that kind of thing, but those tend to be sort of assets like worksheets or PowerPoints, yes, that you want to use or whatever, but it's more about being able to evaluate it before you even take, okay, out a trial. And then the trial gives you more rights to kind,
right,
of try it out. You can't download anything, but you can, yeah, try its full functionality. And then subscriptions obviously give you full access. Okay. So, yeah.
Cool. And then from a human perspective, cultural, mm-hmm, perspective, launching a new platform is always pressured. People always feel a level of stress, but there's also a level of excitement that often goes with it. So how did you coordinate that kind of passion for the launch, if there was any?
Well, I in a way you're asking the wrong person, because I think, yeah, there are so many stakeholders involved, and you know, the product manager has done a lot of work around comms and
okay,
that kind of thing, and it's been difficult because obviously coming off the back of a pandemic, how do you, it's quite difficult to find a way of celebrating that sort of thing in a,
yes,
way that you would if you were all together. I think a lot of people were very tired. There was a lot of work that happened. But there was also a general air of real satisfaction at what had,
right,
been achieved, because it's just the starting point for something like this. You know, the real essence of what makes that service is not really the fact that it's got a responsive interface and you can share it through Google Classroom. It's what's in there. Yeah. And how does that enhance teaching and learning and outcomes? That comes over time. Nice. So there is backlist in there, but there's frontlist publishing coming through now that will be pushed through to users. So yeah.
Cool. So what was my next question? Given the launch, I'm sure you're all very tired, and with global and distributed teams, it's always difficult. How did you maintain that communication across the projects, especially if you were kind of across countries?
Well, there were regular stand-ups that the PMs had with the developers, a lot of internal comms. So we had a standing weekly team across all the team meeting across all the departments. Yeah. Internal digital meetings were very regular, and particularly between the heads of and the PMs and me and the managers. So it and you know, I think we trying to engender a culture of saying, well, if something isn't working, what isn't working, how do we make it work?
Yes.
So it's not just about iterating development to deliver the whole service. It's also about being able to identify the things where they're not working and be able to troubleshoot as you go, because obviously what you don't want is a kind of massive technical debt building up over time as all these elements come together and then find that you can't launch. So
everyone's afraid of that word, technical debt.
Well, and there was a lot of work to do around all of that, because it's only when the sum of the parts come together and you start to really test the whole thing that you start seeing where any sticking points are in the interaction between those things. And they are obviously tested iteratively as you go, but and the good thing about containerized solution is that you can sort of tweak things to work better at a kind of individual component level, which is good.
Yes. And then, so I was going to ask you how you tested it, but that's always a gnarly issue in any organisation.
Well, it was obviously manually tested. We had we had test scripts being written all the time, and they were being done manually. There are some automated tests that are run by the developers continuously. There was load testing, performance testing, and they did also smoke test all of the APIs and that kind of thing to make sure that they were communicating as efficiently as possible. Mm-hmm. And that will continue to be an iterative process, I would think.
And then sort of a closing question in a way, having had the excitement of the launch and then recovered, do you have a vision of where you want to go next with the platform or with other platforms that you've worked on, and you know?
I think
is there a kind of ideal world for you?
I think the important thing is that the business has a vision for it. And what they've done really well as a team is talked to teachers. And I think as long as they continue to do that, then they will decide upon how they want to iterate that platform and what content they want to put in there. And I think they're going to be quite careful in a way to segment it according to sector. So, for instance, if you wanted a really strong revision module in there, you would start to think about content that was much more self-guided and self-learning focused as opposed to mediated by the teacher. And that would just be one element of the service, but you would think about that for kids over the age of 14 and so on and so forth. Prior to that, in primary, they might be thinking more around curriculum frameworks where you can put all of the elements together and use them in conjunction. So I think it's going to iterate over time. But the important thing is that the customer keeps having a voice within that. And otherwise what you have is a hit list and a priority list that is driven by the publishing, which to a degree, you know, will always be the case, because you know you've got to make things that deliver on the vision of a publisher, but that should always be informed by what the customer is actually saying they want. So
so my last question is a more practical one, and that is, as an education provider of technological resources, what would be your top tip for someone who's planning their new products today? Sorry, I've caught you by surprise with that one. I apologise. Maybe come back.
No, it's okay. No, I think the thing I've learned, I outlined for you where I started in all of this back in 2003. The thing I've learned, I think, is talk to your customer first and foremost. the digital design principles, where you're really talking about the user need.
Yes.
And then working backwards from that to think about how you can best service that need in the environment they're working in. So that's the other key thing, is what do they have available to them, and what will the what will the challenges be for them and for you in attaining that need
in
practical terms. I think that's the customer, we talk about the customer voice, but actually it's the bit that does get squeezed quite a bit.
A lot of people talk about customer first, but actually sometimes time and motion prevents some of that consultation.
Well, I mean, you know, and pandemic has got in the way of a lot of people being able to get access to schools and people to actually test out these principles they're already firefighting using tools that they've had either given to them, or they're struggling to kind of, or they've found themselves and they're struggling to use the way they want to use them.
Well, having worked in operations, I know there's always a needs must plan and a long-term plan, and it's really hard to dovetail those two things.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a challenge for any business, isn't it?
Yeah.